Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the History Hit Warfare podcast. I'm your host, James Rogers, and for this episode, I've delved deep into the History Hit archive to pull out an episode from the fantastic Chalk Valley History Festival. Chalk Valley is the largest festival dedicated entirely to history, and it's taking place from the 23rd to the 27th of June this year with a stage sponsored by History Hit. This episode is with author, actor and comedian Charlie Higson, who you'll know from The Fast Show and Jekyll and Hyde, but also his books on the young James Bond, and best-selling author and historian Ben McIntyre, whose most recent book is Agent Sonya. At Chalk Valley, they brought these two together to combine Ben's vast historical knowledge and Charlie's passion for all things spies, so they can discuss spies and espionage in fiction and in real life. Enjoy.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. I'm delighted to be here with Ben McIntyre, who many of you will know as a journalist on The Times and the highly successful and acclaimed author of Operation Mincemeat, Agent Zigzag, SAS Rogue Heroes, and the younger people here will know Charlie as the author of the young James Bond books, and the slightly older people will remember him from The Fast Show. The younger people will be delighted to know that he's met Johnny Depp, which is quite exciting. I just want to do a quick straw poll. How many people, because it was billed as a sort of family event, how many people here were born after the year or in the year 2000? Just put your hands in the air. Okay. So we must use good
now language. Leave.
So we're going to kick off straight away and start talking about spies and spying. And you and I, Ben, have something in common, that we were both in our youth approached for jobs by MI6.
Yeah, let's start by breaking the official secret.
Yes. Can we do that? Let's go straight into that.
Yeah, I mean, I really wanted to be a spy, so in my final year at Cambridge, I hung around trying to look sort of sinister and wearing a variety of interesting hats. And then eventually, finally, my history don came up and said, what are you doing after university? And I said, I have no idea. And he said, well, there are parts of the Foreign Office that are different from other parts of the Foreign Office. In the sense that they are different from other parts of the Foreign Office. He never actually said what it was I was going to go and do, but eventually a letter arrived from a Major Halliday in a sort of brown envelope. And Major Halliday, I discovered, was at least five different people, because others, I know other people who were interviewed for the same job, and my Major Halliday rather disappointed. I was expecting James Bond, but he really wasn't. He was a sort of overweight fellow, and he was wearing sandals with socks. Which kind of more or less ended it for me. I decided that I couldn't belong to an organisation like that. And actually, I think they decided pretty early on that I probably wasn't ideal, since I, as is now obvious, can't keep a secret.
Charlie...
No, I want to hear about your recruitment.
I'm not allowed to talk about it. Do you think that you would have made a good spy?
I'm not allowed to talk about that. No, I would have made a terrible, terrible spy. I think you need to be a very special sort of person. I mean, most spying is probably sitting in an office looking at computers these days, but going out into the field, pretending to be someone else, infiltrating some extremely dangerous organisation, and sometimes for years people do this, and having to sort of fool all these people and make friends with them, knowing that you're going to betray them and that you could be captured and tortured and killed at any point. I mean, what sort of a person would want to do that?
That's fantastic.
It's absolutely awful. But, you know, I'm a writer, so I just sit in my little room at home and make stuff up and have adventures in my head, which is a lot easier.
So was your first exposure to the world of spying through the books of Ian Fleming, the movies of the Bond books, or in some different way?
Yes. My involvement in spying is, I think we've got people here on slightly false pretenses. It says spies and secret agents, plural, but I can only talk about one, which was James Bond. So thank you for asking me about him. Well, I grew up in the 60s, and like any other boy in the 60s, James Bond was like the biggest thing in the world. The first film that I can still remember actually going to see in the cinema was Thunderball. And, you know, James Bond films in this country have always been seen as family entertainment. So, yes, there's someone gets tortured with a cigar and an ice cube. Another man gets pinned to a tree with a harpoon. It was great fun as a small boy. That introduction to that world. But it was just such an exciting thing. And, you know, so through the 60s into the early 70s, you know, I was a massive James Bond fan. And then later on, I thought I really ought to read the books. So I did start reading the Fleming books. And they're still incredibly readable, those books. I mean, written through the 50s. Ian Fleming was a fantastic writer about action and about things and places. He was very vivid talking about the places that James Bond went, which were normally places that Fleming went to, and was writing about what he was passionate about. And writing action scenes, actually, because I know from experience of trying to write themselves, is one of the hardest things to write. It's much easier to do in a film, but in a book, to try and write about a big battle or a fight of who is where and doing what and to who and what's happening at the same time in other places, and making that vivid and putting you right there and feeling what that's like is extremely difficult. But Fleming was fantastic about doing that. And in all the books, there is at least one amazing action sequence, really well described, like in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. There's a bit where Bond is trying to escape from the mountain hideout, and they start an avalanche, and that is just amazingly well described. And things, you know, he loved things, gadgets, cars, guns, all that type of stuff. So he was brilliant about writing about that. He was less good writing about people, sort of emotions and that side of stuff. And I think possibly that it's that side of the books which have dated most. But they are still amazing books to read.
Ben, what do you think accounts for the British fascination with spies, but and also their deep love of James Bond? What do you think is going on there?
I think there's a sort of theatricality to the British character that is kind of essential to it. I mean, I've never been quite sure whether people are mad before they become spies, or are driven mad by being spies. But there is a thick vein of kind of very British eccentricity that runs through the whole thing. And I think it's partly to do with a sort of wanting to live in a sort of a double life. I think that is very central to sort of British feelings. I mean, particularly the sort of communist spies of the 30s, 40s and 50s, I think they love the idea of knowing a little bit more than the person in the bus queue next to them. And actually, John le Carré writes brilliantly about the British character. He said once, you know, there is... How does it go? He says, there is no more deceitful creature in the world than the public school-educated Englishman.
You know, he can be,
there we go. He can be having a forced 12 nervous breakdown in the bus queue next to you, and you'll never be any the wiser. Which is... And I think there is a sort of natural deceptiveness, really, to spying, which people love. But I'm fascinated by the... I've always been fascinated by the... I mean, Fleming was particularly brilliant at this, at taking the real world of espionage and turning it into fiction. And it seems to me that also spies particularly... I mean, they only are obsessed by their own mythology. So they sort of, in some ways, live up to the fiction. For example, again, John le Carré. I mean, the language that John le Carré uses is entirely invented by John le Carré, but it's used by MI6 now. I mean, they all talk about the circus and the, you know, all that sort of lamplighters and moles and things. That's all been invented. Only the mafia and the police do the same thing, trying to live up to the myth. So I love the interplay between truth and fiction in all of that.
The interesting thing about Bond is that he's actually not a spy. He's not an intelligence officer in the formal sense of somebody who goes out and identifies an individual or group of individuals who have access to information and he must then get that information. He's basically an assassin, which I suppose is more.
Yeah, he's not. He doesn't do any spying.
No.
And he's not really desperately secret, is he?
Yeah.
I mean, when Roger Moore was offered the job, he said, "Well, I can't possibly play this seriously. I have to send it up because, you know, he's supposed to be a secret agent, but he can go to any bar in the world and the barman will say, 'Well, Mr. Bond, here's your martini, shaken, not stirred.'" Yeah. No, I mean, the books are incredibly simple. In the first chapter, Bond goes to visit M. M says, "This is the villain. We think he's up to this. Can you go and check him out and sort him out?" And Bond does that. There are no twists and turns and double agents and twisty plots. It's basically he goes, meets the person, has some adventures with them, tends to get captured, tortured. He escapes. He comes back and he kills them, and that's what happens.
Did you use that template when you were writing the young Bonds? Did you go back to the mothership and read the backlist?
Yeah, well, exactly. And there is there is that great formula of how all the best Bond books work. I was in a slightly tricky position because I was writing about young James Bond when he was just a schoolboy at Eton, which I believe is your old school.
It is.
Yes. We'll talk
Mill Pond silence.
Yeah. But he has to have James Bond-style adventures, but he's obviously at 13, he's not working for the Secret Service. Yeah. So I had to go through all the laborious stuff of setting up a plot and villains and working out a way that Bond was going to get involved in all that, which in the Fleming books he does in, like, one paragraph, but would take me a third of the book to do, so...
I think Fleming used... He was at school with Scaramanga. He was at school with...
Blofeld,
and I think some of them... You would know this more than I do.
Yeah. I mean, more than anyone, he extracted... I mean, correct me if this is wrong, Charlie, but he extracted a lot of his plots from his experience, and particularly his wartime experience. I mean, school, definitely. All the names. He loved getting even with the people who'd been cruel to him at school by, you know, labelling them as kind of... Yeah. Some of them got furious, actually. I think particularly Scaramanga, the third nipple didn't go down at all. Well. It was kind of... But particularly his wartime experience. I mean, he was assistant to the head of naval intelligence during the war, which meant he did have access to a lot of really high-grade material, so high-grade that he was never allowed... I think he rather chafed at being behind a desk. I mean, his rather brutal wife called him a chocolate soldier because he never... You know, he spent the whole time behind a desk, but he longed to go out into the field, but he wasn't allowed to because he actually knew too much. I mean, he really did have access to all sorts of really interesting material.
Which brings me neatly to Operation Mincemeat, which was an operation invented, inspired, created by Ian Fleming. Am I correct?
Yes, that's right. I mean, Fleming was asked right at the beginning of the war to draw up a series of ideas for ruses to baffle the Germans, and which he, of course, loved doing. And he drew up a thing called the Trout Memo, and it was called the Trout Memo because his boss, who was the model for M, Admiral Sir John Godfrey, was a very keen angler. And the whole idea was that if you could drop a sort of sufficiently attractive lure over the enemy, you could hook them and confuse them. And he drew up these 30 different ideas, most of them completely bonkers. I mean, things like he wanted to float exploding footballs in the North Sea in the hope that U-boat captains would pick them up. And I mean, it's completely mad. But what the maddest idea was labelled... number 30, an idea, not a very nice one, he wrote. And this was, he said, we'll get hold of a dead body... and we'll give it a completely new identity and we'll float it ashore somewhere where the Germans will pick it up and we'll pack it with fake counterfeit intelligence and you know, we'll bamboozle the enemy. And it sat, this idea. In fact, he got the idea from a novelist that he'd read. I mean, it was long forgotten now. What I love about this story is that it was sort of... It came from a novel. It was then picked up by a novelist. It was then imagined into being by a whole set of frustrated novelists who decided to do exactly that. They got hold of a dead body. They effectively stole a dead body from St. Pancras Mortuary and they kept it on ice. And they invested it with a completely new identity as Captain William Martin of the Royal Marines. He was, in fact, this poor man was a Welsh tramp who had poisoned himself with rat poison. And they literally created a new person, and they did it just like novelists. They sat there dreaming up a backstory for him, including girlfriends and parents and all sorts of things. I mean, because the story, his pocket litter, as it's called in spy parlance, which is the stuff that we all carry on us all the time, which
identifies us. You know, I mean, I'm sure all of us in our pockets have things that will give us away. Much more so than iPhones. It'd be much easier now. They designed a whole set of different stuff, including a photograph of his girlfriend. And then they took him by submarine, this body, and they floated him ashore in Spain because they knew Spain was neutral, but they knew that there was a particular, very efficient German spy operating on the coast of Spain. And the idea was really to convince the Germans that instead of attacking Sicily, the troops massed in North Africa were going to go for Greece on one side of the Mediterranean and Sardinia on the other. But the weird thing about it was that it worked. And because of Bletchley Park intercepting all the German intelligence signals, you could watch the lie, as it was, sort of going down the gullet of German intelligence. And once that started happening, the architects of this plan began to panic because they realised they'd made quite a few serious mistakes. They'd misdated some of the theatre tickets in his pocket, so it couldn't be that he was genuine. And at that point, they realised that they might have just made an almighty cock-up, because, in fact, if the Germans realised that this was a plant and a ruse, they would realise they were being sold a lie, so they would think the opposite of what they were seeing. So they would actually realise that it was Sicily that was going to be attacked, and thousands of lives were at stake. So there was a very bad moment when, like all good plots for all good novels, there's a bit of a kink in it.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, before we leave Ian Fleming in completely, ask you about A Caribbean Mystery, which is this film, the film that you appeared in. There's just a lovely story we were talking about before.
Well, yes, it was one of the TV Miss Marples, which I was asked to write. They approached me because they said that in their Agatha Christie adaptations, if possible, they like to put in real historical figures to work them into the action. And they said, as this was the Caribbean Mystery and set in the 50s, and Ian Fleming famously had his house, Goldeneye, out in Jamaica. And Goldeneye was actually named after one of the wartime plots, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, Goldeneye was the plan. Well, in fact, it was one of Fleming's ideas. It was for the defence of Gibraltar. It was when Gibraltar, they feared that the Germans might just simply invade Gibraltar via Spain. And so, Operation Goldeneye was a very... It's all in the National Archives. It's a great big file, Goldeneye. Someone should write about it at some point. But It's a really interesting case because, I mean, he was a very good intelligence officer, Fleming. I mean, he knew what he was about. And the plan was a very complicated one to effectively defend Gibraltar.
Hands up if you're a real expert on the James Bond films. There must be a couple in here. Yeah. The start of Goldeneye, the film, are they parachuting into Gibraltar in that?
No, that's Living Daylight.
That's oh.
Sorry. I have the microphone.
Shows how much I know. but anyway, so they said... That's why they approached me to write this Miss Marple, because they said they'd quite like... see if I could work Ian Fleming into the plot. And the plot of Caribbean Mystery is they're all in a hotel and someone gets murdered, surprisingly. Never go on holiday with Miss Marple. And I started writing this and I was having fun with it, and I thought, well, if I'm going to put Ian Fleming in it, I'd also quite like to put James Bond in it. And those of you, probably quite a lot of you who are James Bond experts, will know that Fleming got the name. He was writing the first book and he didn't have a name for his character. And he wanted, certainly when he started writing the books, for James Bond to be quite a sort of blunt, uninteresting, unromantic kind of a character. He described him as a blunt object, and he said he wanted a really ordinary name for him, because British sort of heroes in crime books before the war tended to be people like Lord Peter Wimsey. But he didn't want to write about that sort of figure. And in fact, one of the reasons he didn't want to write about that sort of figure was because of his wartime experiences. He had put together this special commando unit who were trained in... retrieving useful information from the enemy, and he sent these guys out there, and a lot of them had really awful experiences, being captured by the Germans, being tortured, and he would have to debrief them when they came back. And he wanted to write about a figure like this, one of these types of characters. He said, you know, these are very special types of men. And he also said that now that we know from the Second World War what awful things mankind is capable of, he said, we can't keep writing these cosy drawing room set crime dramas, which is why his books were much more sort of brutal and visceral, and these awful things happened in them, because he said the world has changed and so writing has to change. But so there he is at his desk, trying to think of a name for James for his character, and he looks at his bookshelf. He was very much into wildlife and ornithology and sea life. He had a beautiful coral reef on his private beach outside his house that he used to love snorkeling over. And he looked up, and there was Birds of the West Indies by a guy called James Bond. He was an American ornithologist, and he thought, that's the perfect dull name for my character. So I thought I'd put this into the Miss Marple thing that I was writing. So there's a scene at the hotel where some of the characters are watching this talk by James Bond, the American ornithologist, and one of the people who's come to the hotel for the talk is Ian Fleming, and he says to Miss Marple, oh, I'm writing a book, a silly book, and I haven't got a title for my character yet. And so I wrote James Bond into it, and the producer said to me, well, you know what would be really good fun is if you played James Bond. So it was all getting terribly sort of tangled into this plot that having written about James... Anyway, so I thought, yeah, that would be fun. So I went out and I did this little scene as the ornithologist, and I got to say the line as I introduced myself with my bird slides. Hello, the name's Bond, James Bond. at which point you see Ian Fleming get his notebook out and go, oh. So, yeah, that's the world we live in. I just want to remember, while I think of it, you used the word plot before. And I think that's really interesting in what we're talking about today, because plot both means the plot of a novel, but it also means a spy plot. Mm. And I think that overlap, as you were saying, the guys who were loving the creative thing of creating this character for the dead body is exactly what novelists do.
It is, isn't it? I mean, it's also true of modern espionage. I mean, what spies do, generally, is to create a parallel world. They try, either as double agents or in disguise or however they do it, but they're trying to create a convincing world. And the better they are at doing it, the better they're going to be at confusing the enemy or feeding misinformation to the enemy. So, in a way, what spies and novelists do is not so far apart, I think. I mean, the better the novelist, the more complete is the world that they create, that they can lure a reader into, and that is exactly what spies do. And it is no accident, it always seems to me, that some of the best writers of the last 100 years, a lot of them, have been spies. Mm. Somerset Maugham, Graham Greene, Ian Fleming, John le Carré, Charles Cumming. You know,
I was never a spy.
There is a link. There is clearly a link between sort of creating a sort of false world and luring people into it. And one is dangerous and one isn't. But nonetheless, they're similar ideas, I think.
Yeah. But do you think, do you think some of the fun has gone out of spying? We were talking earlier about Bond and the Cold War and the great escapism of the Connery movies and the Roger Moore movies, which we grew up with. And now many of the young people in this audience, they'll really only know Bond as Daniel Craig. And those books are sort of almost like sort of Hamlet with a touch of Freud. You know, they're very serious movies. Do you think that when you watch a Bond movie now, do you think, yes, I could watch this with my son in 10 years' time on Christmas Day? Or do you think, actually, I'll go back to The Spy Who Loved Me? Do you think that something has been lost?
Well, I think the reason that James Bond is still with us today and is such a popular character and has been popular since the 50s when the books were written is that ability to keep reinventing himself. He's like Doctor Who. He kind of regenerates in a new form, and he can be relevant to each new generation that comes along. So in the 50s, in the books, it was very much talking about the fallout of the Second World War and the way the world had changed, and most of the villains in his books are either ex-Nazis or they are up-and-coming communists, Russian communists. And, you know, he was trying to create this sort of sustain the fantasy that Britain was still an important force in the world and that our plucky individuality could go out there and keep saving the world. Come the 60s, it's a much more cynical era, and so Sean Connery was the perfect sort of 1960s James Bond. He could be flip and flippant, and there's a lot of sort of dark humour in there. You know, he will make a humorous comment after killing someone in cold blood. And he's sort of sharp and, you know, he's dressed beautifully and he's, you know, he's driving the lovely cars and everything. 60. You come to the 70s. James Bond is essentially a civil servant. He works for the British government as an assassin, as you said before. And, you know, that idea of a character like that being big in popular culture in the 70s, where everything was falling apart and all those old certainties had gone, it just didn't... You couldn't do that anymore. So the idea of sending Bond up a bit and making him a bit camp and making the stories quite big and daft was the way to go. And Roger Moore beautifully encapsulated the sort of disco era of the 70s. Yeah, yeah.
But Bond, there's no question, I think, that Bond has been very... Brand Bond has been very good for MI6.
Yeah, they're rather ambivalent about it, though, aren't they? They try to deny it. Yeah. And say, oh, no, it's not like that at all. And, of course, it isn't like that at all.
No.
And yet, if you go to their website, it's right at the top. I mean, it says, yeah. you know, they always cite James Bond. So they have a funny relationship with him. I mean, of course, it is complete fantasy, the James Bond thing. I mean, in all the sort of historical research I've done, I've never been able to find a single instance in which British intelligence has killed anybody. I mean, there was one occasion during the Second World War when some French resistance people carried out a sort of extrajudicial execution, but it didn't happen. I mean, nobody ever believes this, but British intelligence doesn't assassinate people.
No, they get other people to do it for
them.
They
get other people.
No, when I had my first interview, it said you're being interviewed not for Fast-Stream Diplomatic Service, but for SIS. Hmm. And at the bottom it said, officers are certainly not licensed to kill. And that was...
that was actually written in the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you signed
And then the salary and, the, you know...
that was a point you said, that's not for me.
Then. Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah, yeah.
No, they, yeah. Yes, they definitely don't want the sort of Bond types. Yeah. I mean, I think they'd be much too dangerous.
But if you're a British... Sorry, go on.
But, you know, your latest book is about the SAS, which is similar territory to the...
They're interesting,
I mean,
those
guys were killers.
Yeah. I mean, some of them were psychopaths. Definitely. Even though that was what Sterling said, he didn't want psychopaths. He did end up with quite a few. They're interesting.
But
the
Bond,
SES.
You know, I mean, Bond. You know, if you do a sort of, it's very hard to psychoanalyze a fictional character. But if you go through the psychopath test, Bond is pretty high on it.
Pretty high on it. Yeah. No, I mean, the SAS are interesting because they are soldiers, but they are also intelligence gatherers. They do both jobs. And in fact, their intelligence role is often overlooked, really. I mean, the SAS are, they're kind of a branch of the intelligence services. But no, I mean, they were, the original SAS recruits were weird mavericks, really. We sort of imagine them today to be, because of the modern myth of the SAS, they're these sort of muscled, highly efficient, you know, tremendous sort of butch figures in camouflage gear. That's not right. They were mostly bonkers. And they had...
So who was the most bonkers?
Well... Quite a good question. I think probably a man called Paddy Mayne, who was the... he was an Irishman. He was an Irish rugby international, which is a huge bloke. But he was a killer, really. I mean, he positively enjoyed mowing down people, you know, in mess huts. I mean, that was his favourite thing. And he never adjusted to peacetime either. He could never settle down, and he died very young. But I think in a way that's what Sterling was looking for, were people who were just ruthless enough to do some pretty unpleasant things, but were not so mad that they wouldn't take orders.
talking of ruthless mavericks and. We've been talking a lot about gentleman spies and the sort of public school educated Ian Fleming, David Sterling type. But could you talk a little bit about Eddie Chapman, Agent Zigzag, and just tell... There'll be a lot of young people here who don't know this extraordinary story of this con man, thief, hero of the Second World War.
Well, he was an extraordinary man. I mean, we talk about people inventing their own mythology and somehow living up to a self-created myth. I mean, Eddie Chapman had been a film extra before he was anything else, and I think he was one of those people who felt that there was a sort of camera running just behind him the whole time, and he completely invented himself. He was a professional criminal in Soho during the 1930s. A very efficient one, actually. I mean, he was the first person to import gelignite to this country for the purposes of blowing safes, and he ran something called the Jelly Gang, which blew lots of safes around the country. But he happened to be in prison in Jersey when the Nazis invaded the Channel Islands. And he immediately volunteered. He was a tremendous opportunist. He volunteered to spy for the Germans. The understanding being that he faced such a long prison term in Britain that he'd never betray them, which, of course, was not the case. So he was trained in a special spy school in occupied France and then parachuted into Cambridgeshire in 1941 He hit the ground, broke his nose, and immediately defected to MI5 and offered to spy for them. And they were never quite sure whose side he was on, which is why they called him Zigzag, because someone who'd zigged could also zag. And in fact, I think if the Germans had won the war, Eddie would have been fine. I think he would have just, he'd have just adapted to that. But they sent him, he was the only spy that was sent back into occupied Europe to work for the Germans. But at the same time, of course, he was actually working for us. And he had the most extraordinary life, really. At one point, he was running, he had one girlfriend who was being maintained by MI5 in Britain. And then he had another one who in Norway, in occupied Norway, who was being maintained by the Abwehr, by the German intelligence service. And he was just playing.
He was engaged to both, wasn't he?
He was engaged to both.
Yeah.
Well, I think
yeah.
he was actually in the end married to both.
Right.
But he was actually had already been married to a woman called Betty, who's still around. She's wonderful. She's a gangster's moll. She's 94 and she lives in an old people's home in Amersham. And occasionally she tries to shake me down, which I quite like.
What caused the anarchy?
How did medieval migrants shape the language I'm speaking right now?
Who won the Hundred Years' War?
Could England's lost patron saint be buried under a tennis court in Suffolk?
How did England's last medieval king end up under a car park?
And were the Dark Ages really all that dark? I'm Dr. Kat Jarman.
And I'm Matt Lewis. On Gone Medieval, we'll uncover the most exciting and unexpected stories about the Middle Ages, hearing from the best and brightest minds.
We will disentangle fact from fiction, bring you the latest discoveries, and reveal how the so-called Dark Ages laid the foundations for much of the world we're living in today.
Subscribe to Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you're researching your books, or even operating as a Ben Mick Jagger this week, actually, interesting.
No,
When you're talking to somebody like, which Betsy, she's called?
Betty, yeah.
Betty. How do you know, it's rather like spying, how do you know when somebody's telling you the truth or when they have false memory syndrome where they're trying to spin you a yarn? How do you...
That's the real pleasure of this stuff, is that, of course, you don't. I mean, spies are tremendous liars. I mean, they lie all the time, particularly in their memoirs. So you don't really, but you get a kind of sixth sense for when you're being spun a line. And one of the wonderful things about writing non-fiction in this area is that an awful lot of material has now been released. 20 years ago, you would have been breaking the Official Secrets Act to describe the colour of the carpets in MI6.
Yeah.
Now, MI5 routinely, MI5 being the Internal Security Service, MI6 being the Foreign Intelligence Service. Crucial distinction. MI6 will never release its files. MI5 now does on a 50-year rule. And so the Zigzag files, for example, were the reason why I could write that book. And the Zigzag files are wonderful. I mean, they're about that high. They're a huge volume of material. And what makes them so interesting is that they're written by and for people who never expected them to be made public. So they're honest in a way that most government files are not. I mean, most official files are either trying to make themselves look good or make someone else look bad. In the Zigzag files and other MI5 files, they're completely honest when it goes wrong. So you can offset what, for example, Eddie Chapman said about it. Eddie Chapman wrote his own memoir, which is a wonderful tissue of complete fantasy. It's just made up because he didn't expect the truth ever to come out. So you can compare what he said about himself with what actually happened. And you get this lovely kind of patina. There's a quality to those files that is quite different from any other historical research, really. So to answer your question, you know, you never know whether you're being told the truth until you've got the piece of paper in your hand that is actually contemporary to what was happening. And then you can really work out what it was. And that's what's so wonderful, I think, about the spy world, is because you can write about the sort of areas that are usually the province of novelists. Loyalty, love, betrayal, romance, adventure. It's all there, but it's true. And you'd probably...
Or is it?
Well, quite. I mean, but that's, again, the question with fiction. You know, you never know quite how much of it is true, but you can create something that is almost as close to a novel as you can get, but yet is as true as you can make it. And that's a real challenge, but it's really good fun, too.
There was there's an interesting case along those lines in when Ian Fleming came to write From Russia With Love. There had been quite a high-profile KGB defector who had been debriefed in London, and Fleming had access to some of this material. And he was very proud. Any of you who have read from Russia with Love, which is, the, if you're only going to read one Bond novel, read that one. It is a brilliant book. But about almost the first third of the book, James Bond doesn't appear, and it's all about the Russians setting up this huge spy trap that they're going to use on him. And it's very detailed about the buildings, and where they are, and what the layout is, and how all the inside workings of all the people working there. And Fleming said in interviews, you know, this is absolutely bona fide true. I got all this from the intelligence sources. This is the most accurate depiction of how the Russians work and go about it. And a Bond fan travelled out to Moscow to see these places, and they weren't there.
All just completely made up.
All completely made up. Yeah. The Russian defector just lied. Yeah. Still a good book, though.
Yeah. It's fascinating, that, isn't it? I mean, there's another example of that, which I've always loved, which is the Cambridge Five, you'll all know about, who were the sort of the communist spies who were all recruited in Cambridge, after Cambridge in the 1930s. Kim Philby, Donald MacLean, Guy Burgess. And they were producing huge amounts of material that was going back during the war to the Kremlin, that was all being analysed back there. And they were very well placed. I mean, Philby was very high in MI6, Burgess was in MI5, MacLean was in the Foreign Office, and they were producing great stuff. And there was one particular KGB analyst, one of the very few women in the KGB, called Nadia Komanechki, I think she was called. She was a colonel. And her job was to take all the material that was coming from Britain and analyse it. And it's a sort of truism of spying, that if something looks perfect, it's probably untrue. And so she put all of this stuff together and decided that because it all linked up, it must therefore be a complete fraud. Although it was all true. And so they just threw it in the waste paper basket. I mean, Stalin didn't believe it because it all seemed to link up. And that gives you an idea of what Angleton called the wilderness of mirrors, because it's all, you know, truth and reality begin to refract each other, and you can't tell what is. So they had this cornucopia of wonderful intelligence material that they didn't use.
I mean, my own experience of writing these books is that you spend so long writing them and so much of the time thinking about the characters that you go slightly mad. I wrote a book called The Spanish Game when I was living in Madrid about 10, 12 years ago, which is about a very paranoid sort of exiled British spy who feels like he's being watched. And I had started a friendship with somebody who worked at the security service at MI5, and he happened to be in Madrid. And I'd taken him to the Bernabeu football stadium. And I'm very tall, as you've seen, as I walked on, and I sometimes have a bad back. So around about, I don't know, 20 minutes into the game, I stood up and just sort of pitched left and right and forward and back and sort of stretched my back. And I sat down and he said, "Were you sending a signal?" So that was the start. And then a few weeks later...
Well, not a very subtle signal. No. It wasn't like...
It was to Zinedine Zidane. Yeah. And a few weeks later, he sent me an email on April the 5th, which is my birthday, saying, "Just to wish you a happy birthday." And I thought, because it was before Wikipedia and all this stuff, right? I said, "How the hell does he know when my birthday is?" And my wife was in the bath. I went in and I turned, it's ridiculous, I turned the tap on. I said, they've got microphones in the flat. And all because I was writing about Alec Milius, who was slowly going mad in Madrid. And I'd become him. You go crazy. I was going to ask you, if I write a book, I have a picture in my head of a sort of 40-year-old businessman on an airplane to Shanghai who's going to read my book, right? You were pitching the young Bonds at the young people here today. How did you work that psychologically? How did you sort of do that gear shift? And did you you obviously had young children at the time. That helps, I suppose.
I did, yeah. I mean, I'd actually been trying to think of something I could write for my boys. My oldest boy at the time was 10, I think. And I thought, I'd like to write some kind of action-adventure thing, because being a boy, that's what he loved. And I was approached out of the blue by the Ian Fleming estate, who said they were wanting to develop this new series of novels about young James Bond. Would I be interested in writing one? Yes, I was. I was very interested. And even as, you know, as they were finishing pitching the idea to me, I was sort of... The book sort of sprang fully formed into my mind. I just wanted to put into it everything I'd loved doing when I was a boy, everything I saw my boys doing, and make, you know, put all that stuff type of stuff into the book.
Did you go to Eton? Did you walk around and walk?
I did go to Eton because Ian Fleming himself went to Eton, and in the books, James Bond goes to Eton. Neither of them, Fleming or Bond, made it quite to the end of their schooling. Bond, for according to Fleming in one of the books, for an adventure involving one of the school maids. And, you know, I think in writing Bond as a sort of Eton rebel, Fleming was taking a certain amount of revenge on the school, but also positioning Bond as that he's an establishment figure, but he's turned his back on it in a way. So he's a rebel, but he's not a rebel at the same time. The librarian at the time at Eton was a huge Fleming fan, and I mean, I don't know if you looked into it, but they've got an amazing collection of valuable books in the library there. I mean, not only the historical ones, but, you know, Ian Fleming first editions, and they're very, a bit like MI6, they're very proud of the sort of James Bond connections. So he was really useful in telling me about the whole history of Eton and what it would have been like in the 1930s, which is when my books were set to tie in with the Fleming timelines. And, you know, I mean, it's hard enough working out what to do in your own school, but Eton, as I'm sure you know, works like no other school I've ever come across.
Its own language, rather, like moles and the circus.
Yeah, yes, you know, totally.
Beaks and yeah, all this stuff, yeah.
And the thing is, there's lots of books written about Eton, but they tend to be written by old Etonians who know that system, so they don't need to describe it. So it's quite impenetrable to an outsider. Pink slips and yellow slips and all these things that went on in the 30s. So it was quite fun investigating that world and trying to work out even how the teaching worked. The lessons. I mean, it almost worked more like a university where the kids were in charge of their own education. So that was really valuable. But then, yeah, I mean, I came to write the books and I didn't know if my writing style would work for kids, if I needed to adapt it, you know, how much the balance between dialogue and description, how much historical information I'd need to put in to set up the 1930s. So all I could do was use my eldest boy as a guinea pig. And as I wrote each chapter of Silverfin, the first book, I would read it out to him as a bedtime story. Which is why the James Bond, my young James Bond books are so incredibly violent. because being a boy, you know, I'd be reading away and I'd introduce a new character and go, kill him. I said, what do you mean kill him? I can't kill him. He's only just come in. He's got to go here and do this and set up this plot. He said, no, I don't like him. You're the writer, just kill him. You can do what you like.
That's a version of the Raymond Chandler advice to writers, that if in doubt, you don't know where the plot's going to go, have somebody walk in with a gun.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm just looking at the time. We have about 17 minutes left, so prepare some questions for the panellists. I just want to talk to Ben about the book that you're working on now, because it's so fascinating, the Oleg Gordievsky story. Rather, as you did with Eddie Chapman and Zigzag, could you just say a little bit about...
Well, it is... I mean, the Gordievsky story is extraordinary. I mean, he was a KGB colonel, very senior in the KGB, who was actually a double agent for Britain for a dozen years. And he was... Spies, on the whole, I think, don't make a huge amount of difference. To world events. Very often, you know, we've penetrated them, they've penetrated us, we know what they're doing, they know what we're doing. I mean, it can make a huge difference, but Gordievsky's story is fascinating because it really did change the course of the Cold War. There was a time, he ended up being a very, he was actually appointed the head of the KGB in Britain shortly before he was betrayed. And he, at one point, he was briefing both sides. I mean, he was telling Gorbachev what to say to Britain, or rather, it was being dictated to him by Britain what to tell Gorbachev to tell Britain. But he was also briefing Britain about what Gorbachev... So actually, you've got that unique in history, I think, when both sides are being told what to do by one spy. And actually, it accelerated the whole process of Glasnost. But his escape from Moscow is extraordinary.
Just before you tell that story, just could you say a little bit about the trickeries and the difficulty of running for an MI6 officer of running an agent in Moscow, Moscow rules, so to speak, and how they work the tradecraft there. That's all. So
well, it's extraordinarily different. I mean, under the KGB, it was, you know, there were a million KGB officers in 1981. I mean, it was an enormous army of internal and external security, and so actually running a spy in Moscow was fantastically difficult. And in fact, in truth, when Gordievsky was there in the before he came to Britain as a KGB officer, they didn't try. They realised it was just going to be absolutely impossible to make contact with him in a way that the KGB were not going to pick up on. So what the only thing they had with Gordievsky was an escape plan, which was that if he did get rumbled, if he thought he was in trouble, they would try and get him out. And the escape plan sounds extraordinary. It sounds straight out of fiction, because the idea, he would, to fly his escape signal, Oleg had to be seen on a particular corner of a particular street at a particular time during the week holding a Safeway's plastic bag. Honestly.
In Moscow.
In Moscow, on the corner of Kutuzovsky Prospect on a Tuesday evening at 7:30. And this signal site was policed by the MI6 officers every week for 5 years. They would walk past this thing. And if they saw a man with a Safeway's bag, and bear in mind they'd never seen him, They'd only seen one photograph of him. They had no idea what he looked like. The acceptance of the signal was that they would eat a Mars bar. It sounds insane, doesn't it? But they actually did, and they would keep stocks of Mars bars with them at all times in case they passed him on the street. That meant that the escape plan was a go, and that meant that Oleg then had to get to a particular point on the border with Finland, hide in the by the side of the road. Then two MI6 diplomatic cars would pick him up. I won't give it away, but they managed to get him out, and it's an astonishing story.
Just you must tell the story about the baby on the boot.
Well, okay, they've got him in the boot of the car. He's wrapped in a special infrared rejecting blanket, so he's not going to be picked up by the infrared sensors as he's going through the border post into Finland. The sniffer dogs start moving around the car, and they can obviously tell there's something going on in the car. And the woman MI6 officer who was sitting in the front had brought her baby along. And the baby was in the back seat. And she realised that the dogs were about to pick up Oleg's scent. So she took her baby out, changed her nappy on the boot of the car, and dropped the dirty nappy on one of the dogs, which of course went, you know, kind of smell. They couldn't smell anything at all. And so that is the dirty nappy that changed the course of the Cold War.
The weird thing is that I've met that baby in real life. At about 10 years ago, I was at a party and then she was there, and she was the baby on the boot.
I wonder if she knows that I did.
That she changed the course of history.
Yeah. It's a wonderful story, and Oleg is still very much around, living in the safe house. I can't tell you where it is, but in England.
I can tell you where it is.
Just
meet me after.
Where he's been for 30 years, you know, and he's still under guard because there's still an execution order for him in Moscow. He was tried in absentia, sentenced to death.
So, would anybody like to ask a question? Is there somebody in the audience who would? There's a lady there with her hand in the air. Is there a sort of roaming mic that could reach her?
You have to sing now.
Do you remember the Krogers?
Yes.
In the late 50s. Mm. Well, I have a story to tell about them that you may not know. They lived in a perfectly ordinary bungalow in Ruislip. Mm. And they went about their everyday jobs. And all the time, their loft was equipped with spy equipment, and they were in constant contact with Moscow.
Yeah. Sounds like the Melita Norwood story, the spy who came in from the co-op, the old lady who...
Fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, no, the Krogers were amazing.
Well, when they were discovered and arrested, friends of mine bought the bungalow. They were instructed by MI5 that if they found anything suspicious, to report it immediately. So one day, digging in the garden, the owner came across a rather suspicious-looking box that was there was red liquid coming out of it. So he instantly got on to MI5, and all these people came down, took the box away, and discovered it was a car battery.
Thank you very much.
Very good. Now, the Krogers were extraordinary. The Krogers were illegals. What the KGB refer to as illegals, which are... There are two types of Russian spy. There are KGB officers who are under diplomatic cover, and there are lots of them in Britain at the moment. They're not KGB anymore, they're FSB, but they come as diplomats, but they're actually doing intelligence work. A far bigger group are the illegals. They're the ones who come in under false identities. And the KGB has always been brilliant at running these, and they had thousands of them in the 60s. And the Krogers were just seemed to be a perfectly ordinary suburban couple, but actually they were sleepers, and they were operating undercover. They were part of the Portland spy ring.
And anybody else? There's a boy in a red baseball cap there, just at the back. Can you see him just standing next to your colleague in the blue jacket? He's right on the edge by the door.
He's got a mic.
I'm so sorry. Great. Go ahead.
What's your favourite young Bond book?
Favourite of my young Bond books? It's a bit like asking me which is the favourite of my own children. I do have a favourite, I'm just not allowed to say. I love them all in different ways. Now, I enjoyed writing all of them, and what I tried in each of the books was to make it as different a story to the other ones. But actually, probably in the end, I think the one... My favourite, because it seems to be the one that's the most favourite amongst kids, is Hurricane Gold, because there's a bit in there where young James Bond and his friend has to escape this kind of maze of death, which was a tribute to so many films that we've seen, things we've seen like that in James Bond films. So that was my favourite. Did you have a favourite?
Mine is By Royal Command.
All right, excellent. Another very good book. Can't recommend it highly enough.
Excellent.
Do former spies and secret agents make good politicians? Because we've got Yeltsin on the Russian side.
And we've got Putin.
Yes, yeah. Putin. Freudian slip. And also we've got David Davis, who was formerly Artist Rifles 21 SAS. And we're literally hundreds of our Mossad in the Israeli side.
That's a very good question.
I would, on the whole, think they would make very bad politicians, but...
Putin runs Russia as if he's still in the KGB, and he's surrounded by former KGB colleagues, and they...
Cyber attacks
and all that stuff, yeah. It's all sort of from the KGB playbook, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, his whole approach to the world is KGB. I think he's completely unreconstructed in lots of ways. And actually, he has a very personal animus against Gordievsky, because... Gordievsky escaped at the time when Putin was, as I understand it, a young intelligence officer in Leningrad, and that was part of the escape route. And everybody was fired. All the people who backed him, Putin, were knocked out and removed at that point. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's rather sinister to have a figure who understands the spy world that well. Of course, the spy world's changed a lot now. I mean, it is mostly now signals intelligence. It's about cyber, it's about digital stuff. But you still do need human intelligence as well. It doesn't work that stuff. You need both at the same time. But do they make good politicians? I don't know. I hope not.
No, go ahead.
What about sort of spy women spies or spy books for young girls? I mean, Bond film, the women are always sort of sexy or duplicitous, but is there anywhere in history for female spies or... Oh, yeah. And interesting stories.
There's a very good American writer who's actually ex-CIA called Jason Matthews, who's written a novel called Red Sparrow. In fact, it's now a trilogy of novels, and I'm going to forget the name of the other two. And it's about the relationship between a male American CIA officer and she is gorgeous and a Russian female FSB officer. And I'd really highly recommend it. It's just been made into a film with Jennifer Lawrence, which I think is coming out next summer or something. I think it's not really particularly applies to spy novelists. I think it applies to male novelists in general. It's hard enough putting male behaviour and psychology and attitudes on the page, and then to get one's mind inside. I think Freud's last words, dying words, were, "What do women want?" So it's, I find it quite challenging.
A woman could write these books.
Of course, of course. And I mean, that's just, I don't know.
No, I mean, there are quite a lot out there, including some for younger readers. I can't, at the moment, off the top of my head, remember them.
Helen McInnes is a female spy novelist of yesteryear.
Yeah. I mean, in the non-fiction world, if that is part of your question, I mean, that women make fantastically good spies. I mean, during the Second World War, the SOE, the Special Operations Executive, which was Churchill's group to kind of destabilise and back up resistance organisations in occupied France, was tremendously successful, and that was mostly women. Women make tremendously good spies, and there is a premium today on women spies. I mean, if the main target is kind of Islamic terror, women make tremendously good infiltration agents in that world, because they're kind of, this is going to sound very prejudiced, but in some Islamic societies, they're almost invisible. They can operate in the background without being picked up. And I had an extraordinary experience the other day. I gave a talk at MI5, which I often do about my books, not often, I do it every couple of years. And they said, would I like to meet some of the agent runners afterwards? And of course I said, giving anything to meet the agent runners. And so I'd expected them all again to be sort of James Bond types. And I could not have been more wrong. I mean, half of them were women. And half of the whole group, there must have been about 30 people there, were non-white. You know, so the premium is not these days on people who look like us three. It's actually very much the other way. Although the leader of the group was extraordinary. He looked like, his name was Wayne. I'm probably breaking the Official Secrets Act again. And he looked exactly like, and probably was, a motorcycle gang leader. He had a great forked grey beard and studs in his nose and his ears and so on. And he was Welsh. And I said, what do you do, Wayne? And he said, well, I spend most of my time talking to very unpleasant people in very unpleasant pubs and getting them to do things they don't really want to do. And I said, well, so who's your best agent? And he said, well, we had this man, right? Because he said a lot of the people were on the fringes of organised crime. The people that he sort of... I mean, nobody ever says this, but Islamic terror and crime, there's a big crossover there. Yeah. And he said, my best agent, right, he couldn't have a baby, right? So we paid for his in vitro fertilisation. And he had a baby, and that baby belongs to MI5 now. You know, I thought that was extraordinary. Quite a good plot for a novel, actually.
That actually is in A Divided Spy.
Is it?
Yeah, there's an IVF plotline in Divided
Fantastic.
Spy.
Fantastic.
Yeah. How we do with the sots of hands? Okay, so let Should we get two at the same time and then answer them and then... Yeah?
Yes, we take one.
So there's a woman at the back who's got a mic. Brilliant, go ahead.
What advice would you have for any 9, 10, 11-year-olds in the audience who want to be spies when they grow up?
Okay, brilliant. And then one more...
There's a guy down here.
There's a boy there in green. Can we rush a microphone forward just to this boy here in green?
Oh, hang on, sorry. Let's take three.
Take three.
Yes. Brilliant.
How do you know if someone living near you is a spy?
You don't. We can answer that very quickly.
Take this.
And then just right at the front, there's a... Do you want to go? Yeah? It's just
the guy in the green,
on the
though.
Purple row, yeah.
What's your favourite James Bond bad guy?
Ah.
Charlie, that's one for you.
That's a much easier question than how do you know if someone near you is a spy. For me, it's got to be Blofeld. He was particularly the Donald Pleasance Blofeld in You Only Live Twice, which I saw at the... probably about your age, maybe a bit younger, but the perfect age to go and see a James Bond film. And he had everything. He was bald, he had a scar, he had a weird jacket, he had a cat, and he had a pool full of piranhas, and his base was in a hollowed-out volcano that had a sliding roof to fire rockets out of. Now, what is better than that?
Perfect. I'd have to go with Jaws. Jaws is sort of at once absolutely terrifying and hugely entertaining. Yeah.
I loved Odd Job too. And how do you join now? I mean, the answer actually is rather prosaic. You don't have, like I did and Charlie did, have to wait to get the tap on the shoulder. You can simply apply online. I mean, you just look up the MI5 or MI6 website and have a go.
Yeah. You still do get tapped on the shoulder, obviously.
But I wouldn't advise it as a career. Not being in the field.
I don't know. It's pretty important. I mean, I think it probably matters more today than it's ever mattered.
I think the younger generation should be going into politics We need good politicians. Yeah. I think that's the great problem in the society now. We don't need any more spies. We need good leaders.
Need people to control them.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. We have 25 seconds left. We can do one more. There's a man in the purple there.
Between you, who would you see as the next James Bond?
Between us, who would we see as the next James Bond?
Well, they always manage to surprise us and come up with someone that we weren't expecting. But particularly with Daniel Craig. And a lot of people before he was James Bond thought, oh, yeah, you won't be very good. But Casino Royale, I think, is one of the best Bond films. Unfortunately, the ones since then haven't been as good. I'm very keen on a guy called James Norton, who is in Grantchester, is in Happy Valley, War and Peace. He's got, for me, he's got that combination of sort of public school rugby player sort of toughness, and he's sort of good-looking but ugly at the same time. So I think he'd make a great James Bond.
I suppose mine is... I would love James McAvoy to do it, but he's probably too old. But he's got that great feral face that makes you think there's something dodgy about him. And I think we want a slightly dodgier Bond now. One is
still got to be able to hold his own in a punch up.
Well, I think he probably would be able to do that. He'd be my candidate. What about yours, son?
I think Fassbender would be very good, but again, he's probably getting too old. Because I think Daniel Craig will do at least one more, and then the next Bond will have to be, at the moment, he'll have to be about 35. And so then, although Roger Moore was 46 when he did Live and Let Die, why do I know so much
about Roger Moore? And he was 58 when he did his last one.
Yeah.
He didn't do a lot of punch-ups in that one.
No.
Can I offer you one very odd fact about the James Bond? And we wouldn't be sitting here if this had happened, that originally, and correct me if this is wrong, Casino Royale was going to be called The Undertaker's Wind.
The one set in Jamaica.
That's right. I can't remember.
Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die.
Yes.
Now, if it had been called The Undertaker's Wind, which to me sounds like a flatulent mortician,
yes.
No one would have bought the books. No. James Bond would never have happened, and we wouldn't be sitting here now.
And before you go, remember, as a Warfare listener, you get a special discount at History Hit. Subscribers get access to blissfully uninterrupted ad-free podcasts and thousands of hours of history documentaries. You've got everything from the American Revolution to my own documentaries like Traces of War, Weapons of War, and 24 Hours in Normandy, where I follow in the footsteps of the Green Howards on D-Day, from their beach landings to being awarded the Victoria Cross, and all the way through their first day where they made it 7 miles inland, further than any other British or American unit. So head over to historyhit.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes and use the code WARFARE to get 50% off your next 3 months. That's the code WARFARE to get 50% off. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free episodes within the app. So give it a go. I know you're gonna love it.